Good morning. Good morning to all of you. Reminds me of a song leader I used to know, and some of you may know who I'm speaking of, but when he kept here to lead songs, he would tell you what song it was and this and that, and then he'd turn the microphone that way for you. And he'd bring it back and everyone. And I don't know if some, do any of you know who I'm talking about? No? Some of you? I know some of you were in that congregation, so anyway, it was humorous. He was a good friend of mine. It's good to see all of you. Glad to be here. Always glad to be here amongst God's people, and it's nice to be amongst spiritual family. Hope your week is going well, and the upcoming week will go well for you as well. Through the centuries, the Jewish people have had much to endure. In the Bible, there is a book that is about one of those periods of time. That book is the book of Esther. The book of Esther is one of five different books that are read by the Jews at different times of the year, and is part of what is known as the Megillah. Esther is read during Purim, which commemorates the saving of the Jewish people during a time when the Persian Empire ruled. Some actually reject the book as being part of the Bible, partly because God's name is not mentioned in it. The book of Esther is about a Jewish girl that was orphaned and became queen of the Persian Empire. She was reared by her older cousin, Mordecai, who was also a Jew. Today, I'd like to go through the book of Esther with you, covering some background, history, and lessons that apply to us today. First, some background. Esther has long been a controversial book. As previously mentioned, some reject the book because of the absence of any mention of God. And while it is true that God is not named or directly referred to in the reading of the book, some have proposed that God's name is hidden in four separate verses in Esther in acrostic style. This is found in the following four verses, if you care to write them down. Esther chapter 1, verse 20, chapter 5, verse 4, and verse 13, and the fourth one is chapter 7, verse 7. The acrostic style is supported by other carefully structured acrostic spellings that appear elsewhere in several other books in the Old Testament. In these four examples in Esther, the divine name Yahweh, what we know as Yahweh, YHWH, is spelled out from the first or last letters of the words in these verses that I gave you. That's in the Hebrew now. God's name is hidden in the story of Esther, but his presence is evident beyond measure. We will see that there are circumstances in the story contributing to the amazing outcome that clearly demonstrates God's involvement, and that it was not one of time and chance. Furthermore, the reliance on fasting and Mordecai's certainty of deliverance from another place if Esther failed to act are veiled references to beseeching God and trusting in his providence. Indeed, the main theme of Esther is miraculous intervention and preservation of his people. Jews the world over consider the story of this book to be one of the greatest evidences of God's hand in the course of human history to preserve them as a people. We are first introduced to two of the main characters in the story of Esther in chapter 2, verse 5 and verse 7. And I'll ask you to turn there with me at Esther 2. In verse 5, we find that there is a Jew named Mordecai in Shushan, otherwise known as Susa. And in verse 7, we see that Queen Esther's Hebrew name is Hadassah, meaning myrtle. This is the name by which she was probably known to the Jewish community. If Mordecai had a Jewish name, it's not recorded. The name Esther is a form of Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of love and war. It should be realized that the name Ishtar shares the same derivation as Esther, referring specifically to the planet Venus. The goddess Venus and the goddess Ishtar are in fact one and the same. Mordecai is a Hebrew transliteration of the Babylonian name, divine name, Marduk, the patron god of Babylon. The Nelson Study Bible notes that Jewish people in antiquity customarily had two names when they lived in regions distant from Israel. One would be their secular name, a name understandable in their adopted culture, and the other would be their sacred name given in Hebrew. The secular names that the Israelites would have, the secular names born in the case of Mordecai and Esther, being overtly pagan, has been a source of controversy regarding this book. Some fault them in this matter, yet it could be that their parents were the ones who chose those names. Moreover, the names may have been viewed as merely common or secular and not really considered as pagan. Consider the parents today who may name a daughter Diana without giving any thought to the name, to that name being of the pagan goddess. Although that would seem to be less likely back then in a society that was more attentive to the deities at the time. Another possibility about their names is that their king is the one who gave them their names. That's possible. Recall that Daniel and his three friends were given pagan names by Nebuchadnezzar's chief eunuch. Perhaps those names came from Nebuchadnezzar himself. You find that in the first chapter of Daniel. In the case of Esther, though, some have pointed out that the Jews would have understood this name as sounding like the Hebrew word for hidden. If so, it is possible that this was a clever dodge by bearing a name familiar amongst the Babylonians, yet having a Jewish meaning and one that pointed to her hiding her identity. As a side note, some believe that goes along with the idea that God is hidden in the story. We should bear in mind the fact that Mordecai charged Esther not to reveal her Jewish identity. You'll find that in Esther 2, verse 10. Whatever the reason for bearing those names, we might consider why the Gentile names are the ones used most exclusively throughout the account. And here again is a reason some find fault with Esther and Mordecai and view this book negatively. But it's worth noting that none of the Bible's human heroes, with the exception of Jesus Christ, were perfect. So if they did have these names for whatever reason, and it was a fault, they weren't perfect any more than you and I. However, it could well be that this book was written as a Persian state chronicle. And this would adequately explain the uses of the non-Hebrew names and why God's name is not mentioned in the book. The book is a lot about them standing up for who they are and being bold in that. And if you would like further background about this book, I would encourage you to read about this in the church's Bible reading program. Now let's get to some of the story and some history. I'll ask you to follow along in your Bibles. It begins in chapter 1, where the Persian king Ahasuerus I believe I'm saying his name right, also known by the name the Greeks gave him as Xerxes. It begins in chapter 1, where he was having a feast that lasted for 7 days. And on the seventh day, when the king was merry with wine, he asked his eunuchs to bring Queen Vashti, who was also having a feast with the women. He asked her to come before the king and his guests to show them her beauty. Now, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but I have heard it explained that he was asking her to appear before him and his guest naked, in the nude, more like a dance. Don't know if that's true, but it sounds like something a carnal man might do after he'd been drinking and eating for 7 days, huh? Possible. Don't know. Whatever the reason, Vashti refused, and this made the king furious, and you'll see that in verse 12 of chapter 1. He took counsel with his advisors, wondering how he should handle this, that the queen did not obey the command of the king. And one of his advisors suggested that Vashti had not only wronged the king, but all men of the kingdom, and she should be removed from being queen, and that a new search should be made for someone to take her place. And this pleased the king. And it is under these circumstances that Mordecai and Esther enter the story. Now, we've already covered verse 5 and verse 7 of chapter 2. But it is in verse 8 of chapter 2 that we see that Esther, along with the other beautiful young women of the kingdom, are brought to the king's palace. Now, this is probably not a voluntarily thing. The search was on for the most beautiful virgins in the land to be part of the king's harem, and with an opportunity for one of them to become the queen. Some of these girls may have welcomed the opportunity. After 12 months of beauty treatment, they were brought to the king for his approval. And as you read through chapter 2, you can discern what was going on here. Verse 14 tells us. Let's read. In the evening, she, that is one of the girls, went in, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women in the custody of one of the eunuchs who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. She was to return to a second house because she was no longer a virgin. And she was kept in a house with the concubines. Before, it was in a house of the virgins. And it's a different eunuch managing both of these different houses. So it's distinguishing what's going on here. Verse 16, Esther was taken before the king in the 10th month. Verse 16 of chapter 2 is where I'm at. And you might make note of that. And this is the 7th year of Xerxes' reign. We see in verse 17 and 18 that he ended up loving her more than all the other women, and he made her queen instead of Vashti. And then we also see in verse 17 and 18, he threw another party. He had another feast. We are told in the rest of the chapter, this chapter here, chapter 2, that Esther had not yet revealed her lineage, and then we're told about a plot by two of the gatekeepers who had become upset with the king and wanted to assassinate him. Mordecai discovered this plot and informed Esther, who in turn informed the king, identifying Mordecai as the one who revealed these two eunuchs' plan to kill him. It was looked into and confirmed, and both of them were hung on the gallows, and it was written in a book of the Chronicles before the king. We'll come back to this a little later. In chapter 3, we see the unfolding of another plot, but this is one against the Jewish people. We are also introduced to Haman, Agagite. What is interesting about this, and Josephus writes about this, is that Haman was an Amalekite, a descendant from Agai. Now, who's Agai? Remember at the time of Saul, or Samuel and King Saul. Saul was to destroy the Amalekites, and Agai was their king. Saul was to obliterate the Amalekites, because during the Exodus, Amalek had struck Israel's rear ranks when they were leaving Egypt or when they were wandering in the desert. They attacked those that were stragglers. They attacked those that were stragglers. Maybe these people were the old, maybe they were the young, and they couldn't keep pace with the rest of the group. Maybe they were the ones who were sick or crippled, but this is who Amalek attacked Israel. At the time during the Exodus, God had said he would have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And you can find that listed in Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. This is where Joshua goes out to fight Amalek. And as long as Moses held up the rod of God, Israel prevailed. And when his hands got tired and he let them down, Amalek prevailed. So Aaron and Hur sat Moses down on a rock and held up his hands until sundown, and Israel defeated Amalek. Now it is in Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 to 19, that Moses tells Israel, before they are to enter the promised land, he tells Israel to remember what Amalek did to them. When Israel was to come into the land and they were given rest, they were to blot out the remembrance of Amalek. And it is in 1 Samuel 15 where you will find Samuel and Saul in this regard, and Saul did not obey God. He thought it was more important to offer sacrifice than to obey. You know this story, right? Samuel said obedience was better than sacrifice. There's a lesson there for all of us. It's not our tithes and our offerings that God is after. He declares he owns everything, and all the earth and all the heavens are his. Now, God loves a cheerful giver, but what he wants is one that has a loyal and obedient heart and a contrite spirit. So there's a lesson there when we read about that for all of us. Now back to our story here in Esther chapter 3. Haman was a descendant of Agai, who was a descendant of Amalek. By the way, if you would like to learn more about Amalekites, I encourage you to seek out the Bible reading program on Obadiah, which you can find on the church's website. We see here in Esther 3, verse 1, that the king has made Haman the prime minister in his kingdom. All the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded it. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage, is what it says in verse 2. The other servants questioned Mordecai about transgressing the king's commandment or command, but he had told them that he was a Jew and he wasn't going to do it. They told Haman, and this infuriated him. But it wasn't enough for Haman to get at Mordecai alone. He sets out to destroy all the Jews throughout the kingdom. Now why? Why the anti-Semitism? Why the enmity against the Jews? Well, we've just talked about the Amalekites, but let's read verse 8. Then Haman said to the king, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. It is here that the plot is hatched to destroy the Jews. Notice when this takes place. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the king, they cast pur, which is the lot. It means lot, the lot or dice, before Haman to determine the day and month that until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. In other words, that's when the lot fell, that this edict that the king gives, this decree to destroy all the Jews, was to take place. And what we're reading here is that this takes place in the first month. They cast the lots or pur, which is where the celebration gets its name. And they cast lots in the first month to determine when the annihilation of the Jews is to take place. It falls on the 12th month. And then verse 13 tells us it was to be the 13th day of the 12th month. What we find in verse 12 is that, well, let's read it. Verse 12 of chapter 3. Then the king's scribe were called on the 13th day of the first month. By the way, what is the 13th day of the first month? It's the day before Passover, isn't it? The scribes were called on that day, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and the officials of all people, to every province according to the script, and to every people in their language. Talking about all the peoples throughout the kingdom is what it's saying. In the name of the king, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. We're talking about this decree to destroy all the Jews. Letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, young children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And after you kill them, you can plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all peoples, that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went out hastily by the king's command. They didn't waste any time, and a decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel, the palace, so that the king, and once this was done, the king and Haman sat down to drink after they declares this and makes this edict. They sit down to drink and party, but the rest of the city was perplexed or in confusion, as the margin says. In chapter 4, in verse 1, Mordecai learns of this decree. Let's read it. And while Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried with a loud and bitter cry. In verse 5, Esther sends one of the eunuchs out to learn why Mordecai is so upset. Verse 7, Mordecai tells him what's going on. And he gives him a copy of the decree to pass on to Esther. He gives her a copy of the decree, verse 7. And in verse 8, he also tells or explains to the eunuch that he wanted him to explain to her that she might just go in and petition the king on behalf of the people. Esther, at first, is hesitant to do that because of the law that says anyone who goes in the inner court before the king and had not been summoned will be put to death, except for the person to whom the king extends the golden scepter. She also tells Mordecai, I haven't been into seeing the king in 30 days. You know, this is risky. Mordecai then tells her in verse 13 and 14, and let's read that. Then Mordecai told them to answer Esther, talking about to the eunuchs who have been serving as messengers. He says, tell this to Esther. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. Just because you're living in the palace, that doesn't mean you're going to escape. For if you remain completely silent at this time, Relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther responds that she, her handmaidens, and all the Jews in the city should fast 3 days and three nights, night and day. After that, after the fast, she will go in to see the king. And if it costs her her life, so be it. Again, take note when all of this is happening. Chapter 4 is taking place on the 14th day of the first month, Passover. The 3-day fast takes place after the Passover. In chapter 5, after the fast, Esther goes in before the king, and she does not die. He extends to her the golden scepter and says, "What do you want from me? What is your request? I will grant you it up to the half of my kingdom." Now, in my mind, that's just kind of the way we say, what's mine is yours, right? He's just saying, "I'll grant your request. What do you want?" She says in verse 4, "I want you and Haman to come to a banquet that I have prepared for you." So Haman is quickly fetched, and at the banquet, the king asks Esther again, "What do you want?" And she answers in verse 8, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king," this is chapter 5, "if I have found favor in the sight of the king and it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So they came to the first banquet, and here she says, they come to it, and he asks her, "What do you want?" She says, "Come again tomorrow, and I will tell you my requests." We don't know why she does this. We're not told. But it did allow for some amazing things to take place. We read in chapter 6 that the king couldn't sleep that night. See that in verse 1. So he asked for someone to come in and read from the book of Chronicles. Undoubtedly, he was doing this on purpose because he's thinking, book of Chronicles, this is boring enough, this will put me to sleep, right? Yeah. But it is found in verse 2 where Mordecai informed the king about the assassination plot against him, which we read about earlier. Let's read verse 3. Then the king says, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servant who attended him said, "Nothing. Nothing has been done for him." You go through the rest of the chapter, you see verse 4, I think it's important we read this one. And the king says, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered into the outer court of the king's palace to suggest to the king that he hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And you can read about that in the last part of chapter 5, okay? And so the king's servant answers him and says, "Haman's here." The king says, come on in. And so the king asks Haman, "What should be done?" And he's not telling him who he's talking about. "What should be done for this man? And what should be bestowed upon him?" And Haman thinks, "Who else but me does the king want to honor?" And so he's thinking, okay, this is what should be done. And you can read the rest of the story. And the king buys into it, and he loves it. And he says, "Perfect. That's what I want you to do for Mordecai." Right? Esther didn't know any of this was going to happen when she said, "Come to the banquet the next night." The king couldn't sleep. He reads, or has read to him, the story about the assassination and that Mordecai was never rewarded for it. And the Persian kings always liked to take care of those who took care of them. You know, if someone did him a favor like that, they wanted to reward him. And for some reason, he did not. So it was a matter of honor also on his part. Esther had no idea that this was going to happen, but God knew it was going to happen. And this whole story really demonstrates to us who is in charge, who is running things and is intervening and guiding these events. The story goes on, and I encourage you to read the rest of it on your own. And in the end, Haman is hanged on the gallows that he had built to hang Mordecai on. God saves the Jews through Esther, and Mordecai is elevated to the position that Haman had, and now Mordecai is the prime minister of the kingdom under the king. But they still had a problem before them. The day when the Jews were to be exterminated was still coming up. It was in the future. And by Persian law, it couldn't be altered. However, what could be done was that another law could be written that overrides the earlier law. And that is what they did. Remember, this is taking place around the Passover in the day that the Jews were to be killed from the decree of was in the 12th month. In other words, this is happening in the spring of the year, but it wasn't until 12 months later, because of the casting of the lots, it was determined what day that all of this destruction on the Jewish people were to take place. When the second decree went out, it gave them a lot of time to prepare. You can see that in chapter 8, verse 7, and verse 8 on down, okay? This is where Esther had gone in and talked to the king. This is after Haman has been hung. Mordecai's the prime minister. Esther still has to deal with this issue because that day in the future is going to take place. She goes into the king and beseech him, and he says basically to Mordecai and Esther, you come up with a decree, and you can. Here's my signet ring, which he gave, took from Haman, and gives it to Mordecai, because he's the prime minister now, and then we'll send it out to all the providences in the kingdom. Okay. So that's what takes place. They had a lot of time to prepare for this, and it was so effective that we read in that chapter 8, verse 17. That the fear of the Jews fell upon many people that they became Jews. They did that because they didn't want to be mistaken for not being a Jew and be killed as a result of the second decree. And the second decree said, basically reversed the first decree and said the Jews could defend themselves. What it left out was plundering those that would be their enemies, which is what Haman said. Again, what all of this shows us is who was in charge and is in charge. Proverbs 16. I'll ask you to join me there. Proverbs, the 16th chapter. And in verse 33, it reads, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Okay? I think you'll find this interesting if you were to go through Proverbs 16, the whole chapter, and read the Proverbs in this chapter and see how much of it applies to the story of Esther. I found it interesting. I just kind of stumbled on that. And I was after verse 33, but I ended up reading the rest of the chapter, and I was just like, wow, this really fits. This really fits. I encourage you to do that. Now, let's move on to some lessons that we can draw from the book of Esther. We'll go through some of these quickly. And these won't be all of them, but we'll look at some parallels. Purim symbolizes Jesus Christ. The 3-day fast is the same time period that Jesus was in the grave. But there's more. Haman plots to kill the Jews on what day? We've already talked about this. The 13th day of the month, the day before Passover, right? What day did Judas betray Jesus? Scriptures indicate it was on the 13th day of the first month, the day before Passover. Judas was paid in silver. What was offered in payment to carry out Purim? Silver. Silver. The end of the fast was 3 days and 3 nights. The resurrection was after 3 days and 3 nights in the tomb. The king's new decree symbolizes Christ's triumph over the old decree. Remember in Persia, the decree went out, it can't be altered. The only way they got around that was because they issued another decree so that it would override it. According to the laws of the Persians, it could not change. The old decree, the death penalty, which is hanging over our heads, It's just as the first decree hung over the, the death sentence over the heads of the Jewish people. Same parallel there. It's like the wages of sin hang over our heads. Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death. It is the last part of that verse that is the second decree. The gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus, our Lord. The new decree triumphs over the old decree, just as mercy triumphs over judgment. James 2, verse 13. What is interesting is that the law was not revoked. The wages of sin is death. It had to be fulfilled. Instead of it being canceled, a law was issued that countermanded the earlier decree. The earlier law was not, could not be revoked, and it had to be fulfilled. Christ fulfilled that law in our stead, taking on that penalty. Exposing Haman is symbolic of exposing sin. Haman is like Pharaoh, representing Satan, Satan who wants to destroy all of God's people. The story of Esther pictures a Christian's walk in a new life. And once Haman, representing sin in the flesh, is put to death, God's servant Mordecai is put in charge. Isn't that what happens with us as a result of baptism? The old man is put to death. And we know the future that God has in store for all of us. And who will be put in charge later? It won't be Satan. It won't be Satan. These are all parallels, brethren, from this story. And in parallels to the life of a Christian. Another takeaway we can take is we can't judge. We can judge wrongful behavior, but don't be too quick to judge. Some may think, well, what is Esther doing marrying a pagan king? Well, the Talmud says she was taken against her will. And chapter 2 bears that out. Samson, another example of this, is Samson married a Philistine. And you can read about that in Judges 14, verses 1 through 4. His parents opposed that marriage, and rightfully so. But they didn't know what it says there in verse 4, back there in Judges 14, that it was of the Lord and that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. Be slow to judge. We can't know other people's motives or thoughts or how God is working things out, is the lesson. Another lesson is be faithful to God. Mordecai didn't hide he was a Jew. He told Esther to conceal it, but he did not. Even the king knew he was a Jew because at one time he said, Mordecai the Jew. In Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, some stopped the mouths of lions. Some quenched the violence of fire. But some who were faithful, God allowed to die. They all had faith, but faith didn't save them all as far as their physical life. God will resurrect them, and they will have it better than it was ever been for and ever will be when he resurrects them. The point is, God is still working things out. Another lesson that we can take away from all of this is know that you have a purpose. When Esther was reluctant to go into the king, Mordecai said, "Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Same for you. Who knows what God will do for you? God has a purpose for you, and that is why he's called you, and that is why you are here today. Certainly a further lesson is respect those who have authority. As Mordecai did the king, he respected the king. And we're to do that. We're to respect those in authority. But always be faithful and loyal to God and not to man. Furthermore, we should be aware of the boomerang effect. What we reap, we sow. And there's poetic justice. Haman was hanged from the gallows that he had made for Mordecai. Psalm 7 verse 15 talks about the wicked who digs a pit for someone else, but he himself falls into it. And of course you recall the story of Daniel and the lion's den. They were those who wanted Daniel's demise, but what happened? After Daniel was spared, they were all thrown into the lion's den and were killed. They suffered the fate that they wanted Daniel to suffer. We should always trust God for deliverance. If not now, later, where we will all have eternity to rejoice. Trust God for deliverance. And this is what Purim is all about. All of these different lessons are for us. Someone once remarked that most Jewish holidays can be summed up in three sentences. They tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. And when you think about it, with the Passover, you had the death angel, right? That passed over them. And then with the days of unleavened bread, you had Pharaoh chasing after the Israelites and the crossing of the Red Sea on the seventh day of unleavened bread. They were going to bring them back into slavery, and who knows what they were going to do to them. They ended up dead. And then the story of Purim and Hanukkah, which is the deliverance of the Jews when they fought against, I think it was the Persian king, Ataius Epiphanes, and he wanted to either them to give up their Jewish faith or he would kill them. But all of these things are pretty much summed up with those three sentences. They tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. It's a celebration, right? The 13th day of the 12th month is when Purim falls. This year, it is on the evening of March 9th. Sometimes we do not pay attention to Purim because it is not one of God's commanded festivals in Leviticus 23. Even though we're not commanded to observe Purim, it does have meaning for us. And it should be noted that if the events that happened in Esther did not happen, you and I would not be sitting here today. These were ancient and historical events, but if God had not intervened and delivered the Jews, you and I would not be here today because there would be no Jewish people. There would be no Messiah, no Savior, no Christianity, no Church of God. Because if the Jewish people would have been exterminated, there would have been no lineage to Judah and to the line of David for the Messiah to come through. And as we have seen, and as we draw closer to the Passover this year, let's be mindful of these lessons and all that the book of Esther teaches us.